Welcome to the BMJ podcast. I'm Cameron Abbasi, Editor-in-Chief of the BMJ. The biggest news in medicine this week, at least in the UK, has been the publication of the long-awaited independent review of gender identity services for children and young people, also known as the CAS review. Hilary Cass, the former president of the Royal College of Paediatrics, has spent the last 3 years collating the evidence for treatment of young people who are gender questioning. She's been engaging with those young people, their families and their clinicians, all with the aim of improving NHS treatment of this complex and vulnerable group. The report is already being influential. Its interim publication in 2022 led to the closure of the Centralised Gender Identity Development Service, also known as the Tavistock Clinic. And the final report has led to the prescription of puberty blockers only as part of a clinical trial to young people. That's the key issue Cass has found. The treatment of young gender-questioning people started deviating from the evidence base some time ago. And what research has been carried out has not met what we would consider the bar set for any medical intervention. For example, of more than 100 studies examining the role of puberty blockers and hormone treatment for gender transition, only two were of passable quality. One emerging criticism of the CAS review is that it sets the methodological bar too high for research to be included in its analysis and that it discarded too many studies on the basis of quality. In fact, the reality is different. Studies in gender medicine fall short in terms of methodological rigor. The methodological bar for gender medicine studies has been set too low, which has generated research findings that are therefore hard to interpret. In this interview, I spoke with Hilary Cass in depth about her review, about that evidence base, but also about the way in which the siloing of care for young trans people has failed them. We talk about the need to support young people in their journey, and she's clear that the NHS should allow young people to explore their gender, but that ultimately may not mean medical intervention at all. Could you tell us a little bit about your clinical experience and why you were asked to conduct this review?
Yes, so I'm a paediatrician. My clinical specialty was in children with disability, but I have had a number of management and policy roles, and probably most significantly, I was president of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health.
So the aim of the review is to ensure that children and young people who are questioning their gender identity or experiencing gender dysphoria receive a high standard of care. How did you go about that?
Okay, we tried to make this as wide-ranging and multidimensional as possible. I mean, quite clearly, the absolute starting point had to be looking at the evidence. We also looked to try and improve the evidence with some commissioned research. But what was crucial is we couldn't undertake this review without the enormous engagement we've had from children and young people with lived experience, their families, and professionals from a really wide range of backgrounds who have a stake in this. And then the other really important aspect was to make sure that we weren't reinventing the wheel when there were very good models internationally. So we've done an international survey of practice, we've looked at international guidelines, and we've spoken quite a bit to international colleagues, including the Dutch team who initiated treatment for this group in the first instance. It's been a case of collating all of that information to try and bring through our recommendations.
I mean, you describe a very sort of complex situation.
Yes.
But at the heart of this is concern for the well-being of children and young people.
Yeah. Children and young people have just been really poorly served by what's happened over the last, you know, numbers of months and years, really, because we've exceptionalized this group of young people. People are nervous to see them in local services, and so they've often been bypassed straight through to the Gender Identity Development Service, GIDS, at the Tavistock and Portman. whose waiting list has been growing exponentially. And so what's happened to these young people? They're a very complex group of young people, or a group with complex presentations. And you know, many of them have neurodiversity or other mental health problems, just a range of issues. Some of them are maybe not in school. There's a range of issues going on for them that under any normal circumstances you would expect somebody to address locally. But if people are so nervous that they feel they can't see them, then what happens is they sit on this very long waiting list and these problems aren't addressed. And then, you know, by the time they actually reach the top of the waiting list, all of this has got much worse.
Okay. Yeah, we can come back to that. But first of all, it's quite interesting how you describe the change in referral pattern, the case mix is kind of entirely changed, actually, over the period that you're describing. What do you think is driving that?
Yes, that's a complex and multifaceted question. I think we can't look at this divorced from what's happening for young people more generally. And certainly this generation, Gen Z, the generation who've grown up in the 2000s, have a much more flexible view about gender. Mm. You know, in some ways a healthier view. They're less gender stereotyped than we grew up to be. Mm. And young people are expressing their genders in, you know, many different ways. So that's potentially breaking down some barriers.
Yeah.
But the tricky question is, you know, whether and when the right thing is to medicalize that. And certainly some of the young adults that we've spoken to, you know, because medication is binary, but their gender expressions are often not. And so many of the young adults have said to us, we wish we'd known there were more ways of being trans than just, you know, binary trans.
I mean, in your review, I think you clearly described that everybody needs to be considered as an individual.
Yes.
But equally, people need to be looked at as a whole in a holistic way.
Yeah.
How you balance that seems quite complex.
Yes.
And how are you expecting carers and clinicians to factor those two issues?
Yeah. In? Well, first of all, we're moving the services, or NHS England is moving the services from a centre which had grown with a very specialist perspective on this group into a much broader paediatric setting. The services are evolving within children's hospitals. And what I've suggested is that no one should be working full-time in this service, because by working across services, say in a service for autism and a service for children who are gender questioning, or across an eating disorder, a service in this service, or even between tertiary and secondary care, you're bringing different skill sets. You're not getting a tunnel vision just about this group of children. And then we're looking to a much broader professional group, so paediatricians, child psychiatrists, but bringing in allied health. So we've got occupational therapists and speech therapists in the new team. Having that breadth within the team means you can try and develop a proper plan with that family, with that young person, and have the right people on hand to deal with it. Because one of the real frustrations from the young people we've spoken to is nobody's looking at them as a whole. And you have sit on a waiting list to have your autism assessment. You sit on another, you sit on multiple waiting lists. Meanwhile, you know, time is going by and problems are just not getting addressed.
Let's take the different elements of the various treatment options and begin with psychological support.
Yeah.
What do the evidence tell us, and what's your recommendation?
Okay, so the number of good studies on psychological intervention is very small. largely because I think people have not been encouraged to do that work. I think, you know, because medical intervention has kind of taken over, people have not really looked in a systematic way about how psychological therapies can be used for this group. And it was really important to say that psychological therapies are not about changing people's mind about their gender. It's really critical to say that up front.
Yeah, because there is that concern.
Exploration has been made synonymous with conversion therapy. That's not what this is about. This is about getting young people into the best, most robust state of mental health to go through a medical transition, if that is what they want to do.
And you're saying that if that's what young people want to do, then they should be supported to do that.
Yeah. Yes. For what I think will probably be in the longer term quite a small numbers of people, that may be the right path. But I think what's very important is that you don't make those decisions in a state of mental distress. You make those decisions in a much more robust state. And I mean, it is sadly the reality that that these young people are going to be subject to bullying and minority stress. So, you know, even with the, you know, even under the best of circumstances, they need to learn resilience. You need to, you know, they need to be supported. You need to work with the family.
But if you're saying that the evidence base for psychological support isn't strong, what should the approach be then?
Okay, so I think what's really important is that you still make an individual assessment. So if somebody is depressed, there are evidence-based treatments for depression, and these young people should have them exactly the same as somebody else. But what you, what we should be doing is looking from a research point of view in as rigorous a study at what impact that has on their gender journey, on the choices they make, on their long-term outcomes as medical treatments. So from my point of view, it's really important that everybody who walks through the door of the clinic is in some kind of research program.
Yes, that's quite a dramatic change.
Yes, absolutely.
So everyone who goes on a pathway or receives care should be in a research project.
It's just as important for us to know what happens to the young people who don't choose to transition, either socially or medically, as those who do, because that's what's going to inform the people coming behind. And at the moment, we don't know what's happening to any of them.
Okay, so you want to study it, but what's the role of psychological support then, in this case?
So it's going to vary for every child and every young person. So for some, you might be treating another existing condition, which may or may not be butting up on... So a young person may, for example, have depression or an eating disorder, and they've got gender dysphoria. It may be that the depression has resulted in their gender-related distress, and or they've had a trauma, and these young people have a high levels of adverse childhood experiences, and it may be that addressing that, their gender distress may resolve. But the point is that it is not the intent of the psychological treatment to change their gender perception. It may happen during the course of treatment.
Another issue that's hard to get at, but obviously of deep concern, is suicidality in young people.
So this is a group of young people who do have a higher suicide risk than the general population, but they don't have a higher suicide risk than other young people with similar levels of complex presentation. So compared to other young people with eating disorders, mental health problems, early adverse experience, you know, their suicide risk is similar. There unfortunately is not evidence that gender-affirming treatment in its broadest sense reduces the suicide risk, but but one of the issues is that they are at risk at points of transition, either when they're sitting on a waiting list and nobody's doing anything to support them, or when they are lost between services. Those are points when the risk is increased. So again, I know I'm sounding like I'm saying the same thing recurrently, but it comes back to caring for them in totality and paying attention to all those other aspects of their presentation. But we don't have evidence that it is the gender distress per se that is causing that increased risk, nor that putting them on an endocrine pathway reduces that risk.
What did your review find on puberty blockers?
Still very poor evidence. One of the problems is people are really unclear about why they're giving them, and I think this is why we've got into this difficult situation.
What do you mean by that?
Original reasoning.
Yeah.
Help young people pass in adult life. I'll come back to that.
Yeah.
Buy time to think. The vast majority of young people who go on to puberty blockers continue on to masculinizing or feminizing hormones. So it doesn't seem to be buying time to think. And what we don't know is if you need your surges of sex hormones to work out who you are, to work out your sexuality, and also to help with your brain development, and we arrest that, then have we somehow changed the trajectory for that young person? We just don't have the knowledge of what it's doing. So that's number one problem.
So can I just clarify? You're saying the evidence, what does the evidence show of people who've had puberty blockers in terms of their outcomes?
So
I know it's not a strong evidence base.
No.
But what do you conclude from it?
Well, the vast majority will go on to masculinizing or feminizing hormones.
Yeah.
98% in the UK study.
So you're on a pathway?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're not buying time. Do they improve your...
So you're not buying time to make a decision at a later point?
No.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it appears that once you go on a puberty blocker pathway, you go on to a full medical transition. It's relatively rare that that doesn't happen. Slightly higher numbers in a more recent UK study, but still the vast majority will carry
on. But isn't that what people are wanting when they go into this?
Well, but if you are... say 12 or 13 when you go on to puberty blockers, that's a very early point to be clear about whether your ultimate end point is going to be a medical transition. There's a very small group of young people who have socially transitioned in childhood at a very early age, whether that was the right call or not, we won't know in hindsight. But by the time somebody has been socially transitioned from when they are 3 or 4 and they're approaching puberty and they're in stealth, i.e. their classmates don't know, then they are in a state of real fear about puberty and real fear about being found out. And for those, it's potentially very hard to suggest that they go through their own biological puberty. But we should still, if they do go onto puberty blockers, that should still be done in the course of a trial.
Yeah. Because the evidence, you're saying, we don't have evidence of benefit.
No. So just go back. Let me go back to the possible indications. Buying time to think, no evidence that it does. Helping you pass in adult life, well, potentially if you have them very early in this very narrow group, but most of the young people are presenting too late for that.
Okay.
Improving their gender dysphoria, their body image, no evidence for that.
Okay.
Improving their psychological well-being, weak positive findings in the original Dutch study, not replicated, and in fact in the UK study some people got worse. The only thing that we can tangibly say is that particularly for the birth registered males, if you stop them breaking their voice and growing facial hair, then they may pass better in adulthood. But that is not without qualification, because if you put them on puberty blockers too early, First of all, there are problems if you want to do fertility preservation. Secondly, they don't grow enough penile tissue to do a vaginoplasty. So you might have quite a narrow window between growing enough penile tissue for a vaginoplasty not having irreversible male puberty. So it's not straightforward even for that group of young people.
I mean, you've looked at the studies around this particular question. Are any of them high quality?
I'm pushed to think of any that are really high quality because they're difficult studies to design because you can't blind people. But in part, the biggest weakness is the length of follow up.
Yeah. So one problem you've got then is explaining that. Not only to patients, but to their families and also to other professionals.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think what's important, I think if one can somehow take down the absolute belief that if you don't get onto puberty blockers, I mean, don't forget these young people have sat on a waiting list and they feel that if they don't say the right thing to get on the puberty blockers, all is lost. Yeah. They're coached on what to say and what not to say. They're told, not to say that they're unsure about their sexuality, not to say that they've been abused, because it's so high stakes for them at that point. So long as they can feel reassured that, you're not abandoning them because you're not putting them on puberty blockers at that moment, they're not going to not be able to transition later in life if that's the right thing for them. And I think having a run through service will help because, they're not falling off a cliff edge, that people will stay with them until they make a decision. We need to take the urgency out of it.
But if you're a young person, doesn't this feel kind of distressing and as if the health service has abandoned you? There was treatment or therapy that I could receive yesterday. There might be a trial that I'll be able to participate in tomorrow, but at the moment I'm feeling abandoned.
The new services will be offering treatment to young people. It may not be this particular medical treatment, but that it will be therapy that we feel is going to be as good, if not better. And secondly, those young people who the team feel might benefit from puberty blockers will be able to go on them, but again, as part of a research trial. The aim is that there won't be a group who never get puberty blockers and those that do. They will go on the puberty blockers if it's deemed that they may be the group that will benefit, but they may have other therapies in addition.
I mean, as part of your work, you try to get long-term data or find out more from tertiary care about young people's outcomes.
Yes.
In your report, you say that you were unable to do so because you didn't receive the cooperation that you expected.
Yeah.
Why was that?
So we had a really unique opportunity. We had a single provider that was seeing all the children and young people. And I mean, obviously, retrospective data is never as good as prospective.
It's better than no data.
But it's better than no data, absolutely right. And and so what we wanted to do was link the 9,000 young people who'd been through the Tavistock link to adult data and be able to look at relevant aspects around hospital use and mental health use and ongoing hormone treatment and so on. I mean, this is, as you know, the sort of, the data linkage is absolutely routine in the NHS. It was only complicated in this situation for two reasons. One is the sensitivities, the other is the NHS number had changed. But, NHS Digital did have the mechanism to nonetheless link the data to former pseudonymised data set. And that would have given us, as you say, at least some data. But we went through, we got full ethics approval, which took some time. They were careful, which is appropriate. But yes, we did then just at point where we were ready to go to opt out, to allow people to opt out from the study. The adult clinic signaled an unwillingness to cooperate, bar one, yeah. It's deeply regrettable because this is for the benefit of all those young people coming up behind who need better information on which to make decisions. So it's just not serving the population well.
So your comprehensive review essentially shown that there aren't any high quality studies when we're examining the benefits of puberty blockers. But when we look at guidelines, there are a number of guidelines that recommend puberty blockers. Why is that? And are there any guidelines that are then reliable?
So the guidelines that recommend puberty blockers are not doing so on the basis of evidence. The guidelines that have sort of been accepted as kind of industry standard in this area are WPATH. And up until they're now on their eighth revision, WPATH 7, they still hadn't had a systematic review. WPATH 8, which is the current version, was the first to have a systematic review. And the systematic review showed pretty weak evidence, but they didn't actually base their recommendations on that systematic review. So it's been very driven by what people in the field think. And there's nothing wrong with guidelines that are consensus driven in the absence of evidence. You have to be really clear that that's the case. Guidelines that are most based on the evidence are the Swedish and the Finnish guidelines, and they suggest a much more conservative approach, similar to our recommendations, because the evidence isn't there. And genuinely, I can't think of another area of paediatric care where we give young people a potentially irreversible treatment and have no idea what happens to them in adulthood.
So Hilary, your recommendations and the approach your that's now going to be implemented,
yes,
where does that place the UK in relation to international comparators to other countries?
So in the States, I think it's very hard to make sense of, because it just depends what colour the state is as to whether they're taking a more conservative or affirmative approach. But gradually, as increasing numbers are doing the systematic reviews, now systematic reviews are not out with those in in all of the Nordic countries, they are taking the same approach that we are, of saying, hang on, this doesn't seem like the right thing, and we need to think again and think much more broadly about how to help these young people.
I mean, one of the consequences of the disruption in services is that we have had more young people waiting to be seen, and their care's been disrupted. How do we move from the situation we're in now to one where the service provides a level of care that actually caters for young people's needs in the way that you've been describing?
Yeah, so obviously the responsibility for this sits very much with NHS England to try and make sure that risk is managed on that waiting list, and they are looking to try and get them seen by local services. What we absolutely have to do, and as quickly as possible, is democratise the knowledge about what these young people need. Paediatricians and child psychiatrists and others already have those skills. It's about assessing mental health risk, safeguarding risk, doing the things that they do for any other young person. And the more we can bring this back into normal adolescent care, the better. Mm. So I think the imperative is to try and get, you know, assess risk of those on the waiting list and get them seen locally, yeah, to get those things attended to first.
And so practically what you mean by that is moving this from a tertiary care service, yes, to a secondary care service.
Yes. I mean, in the longer term, yeah, what we really need is good adolescent services, because otherwise it becomes a very costly, unique service, and we don't want something that sits over here while the rest of the NHS is over there. We need to bring this back into normal, usual care.
If we were to look at the service in a few years' time, what would it look like?
So the ultimately there'll be more regional centres. I think Bristol will be the next one coming on stream, but there isn't any circumstance where you would expect, for the numbers of young people, for there to be only one service in the country. That's not safe. Those centres, it was absolutely critical that they work as a provider collaborative, so that they're working to the same clinical protocols, they're collecting data together, they're conducting research across, they are making shared clinical decisions, so that if you walk through the door in Bristol or Alderhay or Great Ormond Street, you'll get the same service. The second component is that locally there should be a really tight network with secondary care services, and ideally a sort of referral hub where an MDT can look at the information about a young person and say, well, it's really important that we have the speech therapist in with this child, or that they're seen in this, you know, the eating disorder clinic, or, you know, so that the right package can be put around the young person as soon as possible, which should be flexibly between secondary and tertiary care.
I mean, there will be concern what happens between now and the point where the service is in a state that you've described it. Mm. I mean, what do you think happens?
I think that a lot more local services are going to need to manage the immediate, priorities of the young people who are at greater risk. But there is, I have to be honest, and there's a worry that some young people are going to go off into the private sector. Mm. They are already. I mean, that's been happening for
a long
time.
And how do you stop that? Is there a way, can you stop that?
I mean, the issue is not so much that the service is private, but that then those young people will not be getting the same level of holistic care and decision making, because in other private services, you know, you may get just as good a service as you're getting, or, you know, in the NHS, but the point is that they are not getting in many of the existing settings the level of assessment and care that they should be, and they're getting treatments that are not evidence based.
We've talked a lot about data, about evidence. But at the heart of this is caring for children and young people. Mm. What's your message to children and young people and their families and their carers? Mm. Because clearly when they see some of the recommendations in your report, it's going to be a hard, very hard kind of message for people to accept.
Mm. Yeah.
What would you say to them?
I think what I would say is what some of the young adults say. There are many different ways to be trans. And they've said that things feel really urgent when you're in your teens, but actually when you get older you realise they weren't as urgent. So the urgency to get onto the medical pathway, is something that... a lot of online information will have told them is the right thing to do. The right thing to do, I feel, is that we need to listen to them. We need to explain the weaknesses of the evidence. But most importantly, we need to genuinely try and find ways that they're going to feel better about themselves. It's very important that they have some kind of hope that, and some sense that somebody is listening to them. I mean, the thing that a lot of parents and young people tell us, They want somebody to listen. They want somebody to believe them. They want advice, and they want some kind of validation for their sense of self. And it's really important that we give them that. How they feel is absolutely real. Their sense of discomfort with their gender is real. But what we don't know, and the assessments can't tell us, is whether it's going to feel the same for them in 5 or 10 years' time. So it's going on that journey with them.
Okay, but do you feel that young people have been let down by the health service?
Yes, I do. I think we've all let young people down, and we've let them down as a society by making them into a sort of, you know, football in the middle of a fight between adults over completely different issues. And we've let them down in the NHS because we haven't provided enough services for them. And that's not down to any particular organization or individuals. It's happened under everyone's watch, whether that's, you know, pediatricians or child psychiatrists or, you know, providers of services. There's no particular this is a system problem that's allowed me, that's just crept up on us, and, you know, for that we need to fix that as quickly as we can.
You can find the full review in the podcast notes, and we've also linked to the systematic reviews that are published in the Archives of Disease in Childhood, which we, the BMJ, jointly publish with the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. You'll also find Cass's opinion article, which is called Gender Medicine for Children and Young People is Built on Shaky Foundations, on bmj.com. That's it for this episode. We'll be back next week with a special edition from our International Forum on Quality and Safety in Healthcare with Amy Edmondson, the Harvard Professor of Leadership, whose name is synonymous with psychological safety. We'll be hearing about her new thoughts on risk management in healthcare. Until then, I'm Cameron Abassi. Thanks for listening.